Okay, it's a pleasure to have Mark Gupta visiting us today from York. Mark got his PhD in Yale, and then came to York, and he's going to be telling us about other interesting ideas about to go after gravitational wave detection.
Thank you, Lewis. Thanks everyone who made this trip possible. It's my first trip here, it's great to be here. What I want to tell you about today is this new thing that I've started up to try to build a portable optical clock with the aim of using it for gravitational wave detection. Before I get into it, I should mention that there are a couple of other things that I worked on. This thing is really what I'm supposed to be doing during the day when I'm instead daydreaming about clocks. But that's an experiment in the Hessels group at York University. We are presently collecting data on an experiment where we are remeasuring the lamb shift in atomic hydrogen. The idea there is that the proton radius puzzle currently implies that there's about a 14 or 15 kilohertz discrepancy on the value of the 2s to 2p classic lamb shift because of the finite size of the proton and the uncertainty because of the muonic hydrogen measurements. We have invented a new technique, and we're quite excited about it. It looks like it's going to work fairly well. The thing with these things is you have to watch out for all the systematics and make sure you don't measure the wrong thing, and so that's what we're doing right now. It's just being very careful. Previously, I worked on electron-electric dipole moment experiments. My grad school work was on an experiment with a molecule called thorium oxide, and that's one of the experiments that leads to the current best limit on the electron EDM, electron's electric dipole moment. I've sort of been continuing it in collaboration with some theorists at Bangalore, and we've identified a couple of new molecules which look like they could be even more sensitive to electron EDM physics compared to thorium oxide. And so I just want to put them out there in case there are people in the audience who...
What is your sensitivity for the electron EDM that you expect to get?
The current limit is something like 10 to the minus 28 E centimeters.
Yeah.
These are new molecules, so they would intrinsically be about 50% more sensitive than thorium oxide.
Okay.
However, it's not easy to translate that directly into limits. Mm-hmm. It depends a lot on the experimental technique and things as well. Okay, so I've already succeeded. My intention in putting these up was to point out that if people want to find me and talk to me about any of these, I'd be more than happy to do that. But let's get back to the topic today. I realize this is the strong gravity seminar. Alas, everything I'm going to talk about is extremely weak gravity, and in fact, it's so weak that even an experimentalist like me knows how to calculate things, and so this may not necessarily be what you're looking for, but I hope you have fun. Okay, so before I start off, let me back up and say that every clock is a combination of three things. It's an oscillator, a frequency reference, and a counter. Okay? You need something to oscillate regularly, something that tells you that the oscillations are where you want them to be, and some way to count them, and that's what makes a clock. So if you think about a pendulum clock, there's the oscillator and the frequency reference there are the same. But for example, if you think about a quartz watch, most of you might be wearing or is inside your cell phones, then what's happening there is there's an electric circuit that's oscillating. It's stabilized to the vibrations of a quartz crystal, and then they're counted electrically. But of course, you can think of other wacky ways to make clocks. You can imagine blowing a musical instrument, like a flute or playing on a cello, and then if you stabilize the note that you're playing, especially if you don't have a good sense of pitch like me, stabilize it to a tuning fork, and then you count electrically or any other way how many vibrations you make per second, you have an acoustic clock. And so optical clocks, which I'll be talking about for the rest of this talk, are really quite similar, except that the oscillator there is an electromagnetic oscillator, a laser, and the frequency reference is atoms. So the atoms tell the laser whether you're on resonance or off resonance. And then you have some way to count how many times per second the electromagnetic waves are making oscillations, and that's called a frequency comb. Frequency combs sort of burst onto the scene about a decade ago, a little more than a decade ago. And since then, optical clocks have become a thing, and that's frequency combs are essential for making optical clocks work. These are the things you can do if you have a good clock. I've just put up there our best values for how accurately we can measure various physical quantities. And you can see that frequency is one of the things you can measure incredibly, incredibly accurately, and in large part due to atomic clocks. And so if you can convert whatever you want to measure into a time or frequency, then it turns out you can turn that into a very accurate measurement. And so examples are fairly obvious things. You can measure distance very accurately because the speed of light is a constant. And but you can also, for example, use accurate frequency standards or accurate clocks to do communication. But for example, one of the things I'll be talking about is how you can use these to do microwave communication with satellites or radio communication with satellites in a way that's very, very sensitive. Okay, the figure of merit that describes how good a clock or a frequency standard you have, I'll interchangeably use frequency standard and clock. I once got my knuckles wrapped for saying frequency standard instead of clock. For people who care, there is a difference, but they're the same thing. So if I say frequency standard, it means a clock. Okay, so the precision that you can measure any frequency to, the relative uncertainty, is set by three things. One is how big is your frequency, and what the noise is, and how long you average for. And there's a factor in there called the coherence time. Okay. And so this sort of immediately shows you why optical clocks are a big thing, because of course you get to frequencies which are very high, and which is why people keep constantly trying to invent new ways to go beyond optical frequencies. There are ideas out there for doing ultraviolet, maybe even X-ray clocks. That's a little ahead of technology at this point, but that's the motivation for going to higher and higher frequencies. And that's really why optical clocks are better than the rubidium clocks that are inside every GPS unit. Rubidium clocks operate on microwaves, optical clocks are in the visible frequency. However, that's just the statistical precision. The accuracy, how well you're doing on stabilizing your laser oscillator to an atom, is really set by the details of how you build your clock.
What's the coherence time?
Right. The coherence time can be set by mundane factors like your atoms whiz through your apparatus and you only get to look at them for a short amount of time. But if you do things right, they're set by the natural lifetime of an atomic transition. Just the spontaneous emission lifetime. Which is why there's a push towards using narrower and narrower transitions, or in other words, more and more forbidden transitions, because they have very, very long intrinsic coherence times. Okay, and so the accuracy, though, is set by how well you build your clock, and it's really set by a lot of experimental details, which is why, for example, even though the statistical precision on paper looks much better for these things called optical lattice clocks, which I'll tell you about in a second, the performance in the end is about the same as what you get with optical ion clocks, where you have a single atomic ion trapped inside some apparatus, and then you slave your laser's oscillations to the resonance frequency of that single atom. And so on paper, precision doesn't always translate to performance, but if you work hard, you can make it happen. So this is a fairly recent state of the art, although the field's moving fast enough that there are probably one or two more data points here, but they're all kind of clustered near this endpoint. So let me walk you through here. What's on the x-axis is just chronological, it's a year. And out here is the performance of optical clocks in units of uncertainty of frequency divided by the frequency. So down is good. And so back in the historical old days, there were microwave clocks. So this starts off at cesium clocks and then works all the way to present day cesium fountain standards, which are the basis for how the SI second is defined. But these other data points, these green ones, are optical clocks. And you can see that they've been sort of overtaking microwave clocks. And at this point, they're much, much better. The reason these points change color from green to red is kind of funny. If you want to measure the frequency of an optical clock transition, how do you measure any frequency, right? And I'm sure you folks appreciate really well that these things are all kind of dependent on what you use as your standard. In other words, the only meaningful things are frequency ratios. And so if you're trying to measure the frequency of an atomic transition, what you're really doing is measuring the ratio of the frequency of the atomic transition to the frequency of whatever you call your 1 second. However, the second itself is defined in terms of these microwave clocks. And so these red points basically mean that the uncertainty is entirely limited by the fact that the SI second itself is not defined to better than 10 to the minus 16 or so. So that's the interesting thing.
How can we do something better than 10 to the minus 16 if you're limited? Because you take the ratio, right?
Right. So this is not talking about the, I mean, these things aren't yet used for generating 1 second.
Okay.
Instead, what you do is you take two optical clocks and you compare their relative performance.
I see.
And so that way you can still get useful constraints on how well these are performing. Yeah. And I'll show you a picture in a second. So that's one of the examples of the state of the art. I'll walk you through this picture. There's a lot going on. But this is all details of a clock that uses trapped ytterbium atoms. The leading contenders right now are strontium and ytterbium. This is an example of an ytterbium clock. But there's actually two clocks in there for the same reason that was just brought up. So in fact, there are two sets of atoms. There's one here and one there. And they're both being interrogated by one laser. Okay? And there's plenty of colors going on. The actual clock itself is this yellow line that's snaking through the picture and sort of coming out of a laser, going into both sets of atoms. And here's a picture of the kind of transition that they're looking at. The units here are hertz. So this transition that they've measured has an intrinsic line width. Actually, the intrinsic line width is much narrower, but they are able to resolve it to a few hertz or so. And then, so that means that your coherence time now is on the order of about a second. And so that's really quite remarkable, because if you think about it, the resonance frequencies are at about 10 to the 15 hertz. And so, and if you're coherent for about a second, it means you made about 10 to the 15 oscillations. So that's remarkably, it's remarkable that you can actually watch those oscillations coherently for such a long time. There are other colors in here. That's what all these other transitions are. And I can walk you through the details if people are interested, but I'll keep moving on. Find me later or stop me if you have any questions. But briefly, all these other colors that are shown here, each of them is a different laser. Okay? And so this picture up on the left is not really, it's very schematic. The actual apparatus doesn't look like two or three lasers with a bunch of colorful light things coming out. The apparatus looks like something about the size of maybe half this room. So and so these are big complicated things. There are lots of subsystems. Each of these lasers needs a lot of work to keep it going and keep it stable and so on. So that's just to kind of give you a sense of the sort of physical scale of these things. And here's a graph that shows you how these things perform. What's plotted here as a function of the averaging time is what the accuracy or the fractional performance of the frequency standard is, or the clock is. And so the best these days is about 3 × 10⁻⁶ per square root of seconds. And so in 1 second, you get a fractional frequency uncertainty of about 3 × 10⁻⁶. I'm throwing these numbers out there because it'll turn out that it's related to how well you can use these to detect gravitational waves. Okay, and so these things are now so good that it's very interesting. York, where I work, is at about a couple of hundred meters above sea level, whatever sea level means. The sea level itself is a variable thing. And Waterloo is about 100 meters higher. And so the gravitational redshift between York and PI is about 10⁻¹⁴. And given that these things perform at a level of about 10⁻¹⁷, this is very, very, very easy to resolve, right? So even some minuscule shift like this is totally resolvable using the technology that's available. And in fact, it's become a problem because one of the things that people who build clocks like to do is compare each other's error bars. They'd like to know if their clock is performing better than somebody else's clock, right? That's how you know if you have a better clock, and you get some bragging rights because of that. But to do that, of course, you have to compare signals. And if you want to compare signals between a clock in Waterloo and a clock at York, you have to know what the altitude difference is. And so it turns out that these clock comparisons, they're important for reasons other than just bragging rights. It's because you'd like to know if you have any systematic effects. For example, if you have a certain ytterbium clock, I have a copy of the ytterbium clock, and my clock seems to run faster than it should, then we know that we built these things slightly wrong or something went wrong. So, but the problem is now these clock comparisons are difficult on sort of continental or intercontinental scales because we have no idea about, nothing in the world has been surveyed at the 10⁻¹⁷ of gravitational redshift level. In other words, no place on Earth has been surveyed to about a centimeter accuracy. So that's crazy because it means that because of this limitation, these optical clocks, which are basically the world's best performing precision tools, have been turned into really fancy meter sticks, right? They're just currently, all they're good for is measuring altitudes, because we don't have an independent measure of the altitude. And so that's a funny problem. That's one of the things that people who want to use optical clocks for timekeeping are struggling against. And one of the ideas that motivates the work that I'll tell you about is that some of these problems get solved if you have transportable optical clocks. So remember I said that these state-of-the-art clocks right now are about half the size of this room. But if you have a transportable clock, you can imagine comparing it. Let's say it's something I can hold in my hands. Compare it to the clock that's sitting in a big lab at York, and then I transport it to Waterloo, and I compare it to the clock here. And then because the clock got transported with the gravitational field, with the gravitational redshift, you can compare the performance between distant clocks. Of course, that requires you to transport this very, very, very slowly, because you don't have to worry about, you don't want to worry about the second order Doppler shift. But given that GO transit is a pretty good approximation for infinitesimally slow transport, I think we're good in that sense. Okay, but the thought that really drives what I want to do is the following thing. I mean, it's great. It's great that we can use these for timekeeping. And what will happen is people will think of ways to use them for navigation, let's say. There'll be more advanced GPS.
How long it takes to transport the clock? Because there is the issue, things can happen. You want to synchronize at the same time, right? You want to take in some sense.
So we're not even talking about time synchronization. That's a totally different problem. I'm just talking about just the frequency, just the rate. It's more like a rate synchronization. You want to make sure you're ticking at the same rate,
let's say.
We're not even talking about offsets and so on.
Okay.
So you want to do it slowly because you don't have to worry about second order Doppler shift.
Yeah.
However, you want to do it fast enough before there's an earthquake in Japan and the geoid shifts.
Yeah.
Sorry, what's a second order Doppler shift?
It's the fact that there's a term in the Doppler shift that looks like V squared over C squared.
Yeah, but I mean, when it stops, you kind of just transport it.
There's no hysteresis in the rates, you're right. But if you're trying to do time transfer, for example, then you'd have to worry about issues like that. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so again, to go back to what the idea is for whatever follows, people want to use these for time transfer, for timekeeping, having better, possibly more improved versions of GPS. But the thought that drives us is that clocks have got to be good for more than just timekeeping. These are extremely precise tools, and it's time to use them for something more fun than just sort of telling you what time it is. And so the idea is to use these to look for gravitational waves. And let me see if I jump the slide. Yeah. There we go. Okay, so this is how everyone so far has been looking for gravitational waves using terrestrial Michelson interferometers like LISA and friends, and LIGO and friends, they operate in the sort of hundreds of hertz or between 100 hertz and a kilohertz in frequency, in gravitational wave frequency. And outside those bands, they're limited by either fundamental noise sources or technical noise sources. And of course, this will probably get better with improvements in technology, squeezing, and so on. However, there is another idea out there, and this is ancient. In fact, it started off in the 70s. And this was, in fact, the way in which people started originally thinking about pulsar timing arrays. And so the idea here is to do Doppler ranging between satellites. So you have a pair of artificial satellites, let's say, and they're sending signals to each other, electromagnetic signals. And by measuring the Doppler shifts between the emitter and the receiver and comparing them, you can actually get very sensitive to gravitational waves. I'll walk you through the details of that. But it goes back to at least 40 years ago. And this is an old plot showing you what people thought would be the performance back in the day and what the typical sources are and so on.
So the frequency is reversed.
Exactly.
It's high frequencies that way in this plot.
Yeah. So
okay,
it's a little crazy. The rest of my plots will be conventional. Sorry about that. Okay, so briefly the idea is that let's say you have some gravitational wave that's propagating down on the slide, and you have an emitter of light and a receiver of light, so you have photons traveling between these two. And so for a photon momentum P and a gravitational wave vector K, if these H's are the amplitudes of the plus and the cross modes, then it turns out that the frequency ratio between the emitter and the receiver is 1 plus a small number that's proportional to some angular factors times the gravitational wave amplitude. So these are order unity angular factors. Of course, there's a lot of fun can be had with the angular factors. But typically, these are order unity angular factors. And so the point is, if you can compare frequencies at the 10 to the minus 16 level, you're sensitive to gravitational waves at the 10 to the minus 16 level in a certain amount of integration time. The thing to watch out for in these, though, is that you need your emitter and receiver to be spaced apart by a certain amount. So because the point is you're sensitive to differences in the gravitational wave amplitudes at the emitter and the receiver, it doesn't help you if you're too close. You don't get very sensitive. If you're too far away, your oscillations all wash out. How would you compare these signals? Here's one possible way to do it. And so if you have an emitter up there communicating with the receiver, what you would do, for example, is generate some microwaves, beam them across, and then find out, for example, at the receiver, whether the microwaves are the right frequency or not. The way you relate the microwave frequencies that you measure to onboard clocks of some sort, and in the following, I'll be assuming that there are optical clocks onboard these things. The way you relate them is via the magic of these frequency combs. And so what they do is, in a sense, take this optical frequency that is being generated by the laser and the atoms inside your optical atomic clock, and then relate that to a microwave frequency with the same fractional frequency uncertainty. Okay. And so what you would do is look for Doppler residuals in the measured frequencies at the emitter, at the receiver, sorry. It's not necessary because you're not sensitive to the phase. All you're looking at is the frequency. So unlike things like LISA, you don't have to worry about maintaining a fixed path and knowing that to some almost superhuman accuracy. You're just beaming signals. So all you have to know is what the local rate is. And just from local rate comparisons, you can get the same. And so you don't have to synchronize the orbits. You don't have to synchronize the locations. You'd like them to be about half a wavelength apart of your gravitational waves. But other than that, it is fairly freeform. And so that's really the sort of thing that motivates me to keep looking at these things, because unlike some of these space mission proposals, this could be a terribly simple thing. You literally just put an atomic clock on a satellite. Like I said, they're about half the size of this room now, so it's not as simple as putting it on a satellite. But let's say you shrunk them down to some meaningful size and put them on a satellite, you would literally just shoot it off and have it communicate with all the other satellites in the neighborhood. Okay? And so that's the sort of vision that drives this. You do need to watch out for the link between these two. If you have noise in there because of solar wind or because the plasma is doing something funny, then of course you get more noise, and you're not ultimately only limited by the frequency standard. But it seems quite feasible that the links won't be a problem. And the obstacle to doing this right now is just the fact that clocks small enough to put on satellites are right now at the 10 to the minus 14 level at best. Yeah. And so if you can kick that up by a factor of 3, factor of 10 to the 3, then you've gotten to something that can potentially be used to do some interesting gravitational physics. It doesn't have to be a full factor of 10 to the 3 on the first step, of course. You could also do this more gradually, but how much optical power do you need?
Yeah, because these are like femtosecond lasers, right?
So right, these are frequency femtosecond lasers, that's right.
So they have some,
they have some power draw,
yeah.
But it's typically about a half a watt or less than half a watt.
Uh-huh.
And so it's quite consistent with the sort of thing that you can do with satellite power supplies.
Yeah.
The clocks themselves, not so much. Like I said, right now they're very complicated. They have lots of laser subsystems. even if you could power them up, it's not clear if they could work uninterrupted for many years at a time. But right now, there are clocks on satellites, the rubidium clocks. They look like packages about yay big.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is plug them in, they just keep working. And so if you can turn optical clocks into sort of plug-and-play modules small enough to put on a satellite that you wouldn't need a grad student to constantly tweak them to keep them working, then that's the sort of power of this this approach. Does that address your...
Yeah.
Any other questions?
So you say you are not comparing the phase?
No, it's not a phase comparison. It's a frequency comparison. It's a Doppler signal, right?
But when the signal gets transmitted from one phase to the other phase,
yeah,
Then the frequency is already changed.
Right, so the frequency will be changed. If nothing else, the fact that these are at different parts in the sun's gravitational field means there'll be big gravitational redshifts,
yeah,
right? And they're moving, you know, on their orbits, and so there'll be Doppler shift because of that. There's relative velocities between them. But the point is you're looking for residuals on top of all that stuff. And so if you think about a typical satellite in orbit, the time scale over which its velocity changes is on the scale of a year. However, I'll show you in a second what the frequency band is in which these things will be sensitive. The typical frequency band is about 1,000 seconds. And so if you have noise on the 1,000 second scale, if there are things happening between these two that's jittering them around on the 1,000 second scale, then you're in trouble. But that's an unlikely...
But does it matter that the signal is coherent or not?
Sorry?
Does it matter if the signal is coherent or not? Because you're saying you're not sensitive to phase. You have to be sensitive to phase, because this is how the phase of the signal accumulates on the atoms themselves.
Well, you're not sensitive to phase shifts is what I meant. I mean, frequency is the rate of change of phase. So the point is that you don't really need to know exactly how far away you are. So let's say you have an emitter and a receiver, and the emitter is slowly moving away. Okay.
Oh, you're not frequency. You're not sensitive to the phase of the signal.
Right.
So basically,
right,
the phase noise of the laser that you use to synchronize the two clocks, for example, the microwave.
Right.
Pulse, you don't need to know that.
You do need to know it well enough that you can compare it,
yeah,
but you don't need to know the absolute phase of that.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Can you finish your example? You were giving us an example. You have two satellites, and one is receiving.
Right. One's drifting away. And so, of course, you would see some frequency difference between the two that's drifting slowly. However, the thing you'd be looking for them to apparently do that. And so you would be looking for, on top of that drift, for some kind of sinusoidal oscillation, which would be characteristic of your gravitational wave. And so you can pull it out by looking in the frequency band that you care about, by looking at the residuals in the...
Yeah, by the way, I mean, things that can appear like that, for example, is like the gravitational interaction between the atoms and the spacecraft itself, right? Because the atoms are not, I mean, it's how good of a rest mass are your atoms relative to the, because the I mean, it's a big mass, it's a big satellite.
Yeah.
Actually, this is one of the major problems with Thalesa and many of these things that when you want to send them to space.
Mm-hmm.
How good of an inertial mass is it?
Right, but I don't think you need this to be an inertial mass is the point. Because all you're looking for is for residuals in the...
But it would appear the same way, right? It would be a random...
Right, but you can pull it out by its time dependence. So if you have something which is jiggling around your clock...
Yeah, but that's the point. I mean, you still have jitters at the frequencies in question. I mean, this is one of the reasons, even in Lisa, right? How well of an inertial mass is, because it moves around at the frequency that you're looking at, is a background. So I don't see how the atoms moving with respect to the spacecraft is not a systematic.
Well, so the atoms are not the emitters of light, so the atoms are only used for synchronizing your laser.
Standard, yes,
right.
The frequency standard is the atom, because your phase...
Sure, so if you're saying that the frequency standard itself is jiggling around on the time scale of 1,000 seconds, then
yeah,
I think you're in trouble. Then I don't think this will work.
I'm not saying it's impossible.
Oh, no.
I'm saying this is something you need to worry about that will appear, that independent of whether you look at phase or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think this will be there.
Sure, there will be mechanical noise, but it's unlikely that the mechanical noise will be spread out over a broad band. Right? There'll be some kind of vibration mode going on. There'll be some...
No. Even the random, you can estimate how much it is, right?
But you don't expect to see broadband frequency noise entirely in the sort of millihertz band, do you?
You do. That's the point. I mean,
because of thermal noise? Or?
Because of, yeah, the motion of stuff. How good of an inertial you want to assume that these atoms are free fall. The question is mm-hmm. the assumption if there's forces from the walls of the spacecraft itself. Gravitational forces. It doesn't, let's not talk about electromagnetic forces because
sure.
these atoms are inside the satellite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm saying this is a big systematic, for example, like experiments for LISA.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see how this is not a problem for it.
But this is doing something different from LISA though, right? It's
true,
right.
But it will appear because, I mean, you have your satellite jiggling around your atoms.
Sure.
So that will appear as, because you're locking your laser
sure.
to
I mean,
the atoms.
I agree that but if there's noise in this band.
Here, but this
yeah.
is something that...
No, for sure. There will be technical issues like that. I readily admit. I think this is at least as far ahead as LISA. The hope is that it's closer than LISA because you don't have to worry about synchronizing the distances of your satellites.
Yeah.
So that's the real push for this.
Sorry, I have another question. So do you need a lot of microwave photon? I mean, there must be some short noise.
Yeah, the microwave short noise will be small because even in a watt of microwaves, there are close to 10 to the 30 photons or so. And you are amplifying these up. So I don't think microwave short noise is going to be an issue. However, the signals will be small because you're talking about satellites that are separated by a couple of astronomical units, for example. And so you'll have to amplify up the signal quite a bit before you can compare it.
Okay,
so here's some sensitivity curves. What's plotted here is how much you can do on the time scale of one oscillation. And I've plotted here gravitational wave frequency. And where we are right now is roughly this blue curve, if we take the world's best clock and put it up in space on a satellite, and if we can get all these other technical issues under control, the sensitivity limited entirely by the frequency standard on board the satellite will be according to this blue curve. It seems quite feasible that we can, in the near term, get down to this level, and because all these space missions operate on the 10 or 20 year kind of time scale, it's very feasible that by the time something like this even gets out into space, that we'll be doing quite a bit better than this.
So
but
what's harder, as you pointed out, is it depends on your phase frequency, where that peak is. And
right.
That
okay, so this plot is assuming that the separation is about two astronomical units.
Right, so no, but I want to find to know where it would be hard to move this one, these curves to the right or to the left.
Right, so it'll be hard to move them too much to the right. Because of the following thing, because these things need time to average down, right? So you need an entire 1 second worth of data before your performance is at the 3×10⁻¹⁶ level. And so that's the limit here. And so if we can build clocks with much higher signal-to-noise ratios, which is also something that seems quite feasible in the future, then you can try to move these over to the right. In other words...
Yeah, okay, continue, sorry.
That was the end of my...
Okay,
no,
and then going that way is a lot easier?
Going the other way, you lose because of things like if you're farther apart, your signal levels to communicate between the satellites start to get low.
Okay.
And then, of course, you're also fighting against things like that, right? You can get signals from as far away as the Voyager spacecraft, right? So you can go 100 AUs or so if you want, but the signal levels will start dropping to incredibly small levels, and at that level, things like short noise will start to matter. I mean, how well can you do phase comparisons across satellites that are widely separated? I know that Cassini did some satellite Doppler tracking to try to look at some residuals.
Yeah.
And so at least up to that range, it seems feasible.
Okay.
But again, with Cassini, I think they were limited not by the onboard standard, but by whatever link they had. And so this is mostly just talking about the performance of the standard, but it's not just the standard, you need the link to work at that level as well.
Yeah, no, of course.
Any other questions?
So how do you get better than this?
How do we get better in performance than this?
Yeah, because if I were to put, 10⁻¹⁶, if I were, okay, LISA is a bit insane, but in principle it has better strength sensitivity.
Sure,
than this.
For sure. Is that true for...
So how do you improve on this? So you're saying that you can have better clocks. So basically what would be... I mean, you're saying you can get to the near future 10⁻¹⁶.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see the where is the bottom? I mean,
where
does
it bottom out?
Let's go very optimistic.
Right. So right now it bottoms out because of the technology of the lasers themselves.
Okay.
at the roughly 10 to the minus 18 level.
Okay.
In other words,
10 to the minus 18 hertz, or is it absolute?
10 to the minus 18 absolute.
Okay.
However, that metric is the metric that people who build atomic clocks use, which is that they don't just care about the statistical performance, they also care about absolutes. Here we don't, right? Here we don't care if our clocks, one of them is running faster, the other one slower. All we care about is how fast can they average down, or what's their signal to noise. So part of the reason to go into this is to at least point out to the people working on optical clocks is that it's not just the accuracy metric that matters. There are lots of applications for things where you have good signal to noise as well. But to get back to your point of what's the limit right now, it's the fact that, for example, let's go back to that ytterbium clock example where you had a coherence time of 1 second. And so what that means is that between experiments, you have to wait typically for a few seconds. So you measure for about a second, you wait for a few seconds, and then measure for a second. In the time between those comparisons, your laser has to keep doing what it was doing.
Yeah.
If your laser does some funny stuff in the meantime, then it's noisier.
It's the
passive stability of the laser on time scales corresponding to the difference between comparisons. So I'll point out in a second, but one of the ways to do away with that or get around that is to use continuous clocks. There are ways to do that. People have built continuous clocks in the past, not optical, but microwave continuous clocks exist. And so that way you don't have to worry too much about your laser drifting between measurements. The other thing is, of course, there are other ideas out there for getting even better coherence times. And so, there's one nuclear clock idea out there, the thorium one. That has a number of other problems too, right? I mean, the actual performance, if you look at that, is actually not that much better than these clocks.
I see.
I mean, it's true, Lisa does a lot better, but the slope is a lot steeper. So if I take the 10 to the minus 4 or even lower, then this one is better.
I see, at the long wavelength is
better.
Yeah,
so the other one just climbs up very, very quickly.
Why does it climb up this way? I can understand why it's limited.
Because for a fixed separation, once your wavelength gets really long, you're not sensitive to differences in the, you're only sensitive to differences in the strain between the two, right?
I see. So you get gradient separation?
That's right. Okay. This is up in the air at this point in more ways than one, but the idea is, again, because you're looking at something that's linear in the gravitational wave amplitudes, if you can do the math and try to figure out how to unravel these angular factors, you can also start doing some interesting correlation measurements and try to get some sense of positions and so on. And I'm sure there are experts in the audience here who've thought about this problem for things like LISA and possibly for pulsar timing arrays and so on. So I'll leave that up to you to tell me more about. But that's an example of the sort of things you get if you play around with the relative phases between signals. But the idea here is, again, to do something like aperture synthesis using pairs or correlated pairs of satellite signals. Okay, and then since I've told you the main things, while you're still reasonably excited, I'll delve into the nitty-gritties of why I think what I want to do and why I think it'll be possible to build a portable version of something that's about a half a room size right now. And so this is going to be a little bit of details. Stop me if you have any questions. I'm happy to go slower. But briefly, the idea is that I want to use a two-photon transition in calcium. So all these clocks right now, they use one-photon transitions. So they happen between, let's say, an S state and a P state. So one photon takes you from the S state to the P state. And so you have to worry about Doppler shifts on the atomic signal. And so to get around that, what you have to do is trap the atoms and hold them in place so that they're not moving around while you make your measurement of the atoms with your laser. However, that's the thing that adds all the overhead to the existing optical clocks. That's the reason why you need four other lasers to kind of keep the atoms in place while your main laser is interrogating the atoms. With this, however, if you use a two-photon transition, you can drive the transition with two degenerate photons, two oppositely propagating degenerate photons, and then you don't really need to hold your atoms. Even if your atoms are moving, it's okay, because that drops out when you look at the combined effect of the two-photon transition. And so The idea is to do this in what's called a magneto-optical trap. It's something that's reasonably straightforward. People do that all the time. And you can build magneto-optical traps, which are conceivably about 10 centimeters on a side scale. And so this scheme would require not much more than a magneto-optical trap for calcium. And so that's the thing that I've started working on at York. And again, the grand hope is that it's OK if it's not the world's best clock in terms of absolute accuracy. However, it looks like it'll have the fast signal to noise and very likely also the accuracy enough to be used as a frequency standard, or at least as something that you can lock your microwave emitter and receivers to onboard satellites.
So what am I, can you explain this a bit more slowly?
All the stuff that's going on here? OK. I put that up there only to impress you, not to. Very briefly, what's happening is this is what you should be mostly focusing on. This is the laser that makes the two-photon transition happen.
So what frequency is the measuring? You still have a frequency. You still use one frequency of all these transitions, right?
Right.
What is your reference frequency here?
The reference frequency is half of the energy difference between that state and that state.
Okay. This is the
L3. Right. It's about 327 terahertz.
Okay.
Right. And so that's the one that you should be paying attention to. So what's happening in this line is what I've shown you is a pulse sequence for a Ramsey sequence to measure this transition. So you have a pulse, wait for a while, do another pulse. Okay. Mm-hmm. But after you do that, of course, while you do that, you don't want all these other lasers on because you don't want them to perturb your transition that you're measuring.
Yeah.
And so you measure for a while, and then you turn on your other lasers and then catch your atoms again. Measure for a while,
so
catch your atoms again. The rest are for cooling and trapping. Yeah.
So, and they are in which directions? In the previous, you had the setup before.
Right, so they're in a magneto-optical trap configuration. So there's
yeah.
sort of six beams that are counter-propagating.
Okay.
So they're sort of pushing you from, right, so they're kind of pushing you. So you should think of it as you measure with your clock transition. You have two laser beams that interrogate the atomic oscillation.
Yeah.
And then while they're doing that, of course, the atoms are sort of freely expanding. And then you turn on your other lasers, squish them back, measure again, squish them back. And so that's the idea.
How is this different than what was done before? I thought it was very similar.
In very broad terms, it is similar. You still need to trap your atoms, cool them, measure them, trap your atoms, cool them, measure them.
So how do you
the problem with the previous one, though, is that you have to trap your atoms to much lower temperatures because you're trying to hold them to within a range of positions that's smaller than the optical wavelength. And so what you have to do is not only cool them, but you have to load them into something called an optical lattice so that they kind of stay in place while you're making your measurement. And of course, the lattice needs a laser, that laser needs to be stable, et cetera, et cetera. So all that stuff is what adds the overhead.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking all these details is because of the systematic I was telling you before.
Right.
If you have any interaction between the walls of your satellite and the cloud,
So that's actually a good idea because it might be that with some clever design of the way these laser beams compress the atoms back, it could be that it becomes less sensitive to where the atoms are, for example.
Yes, but it's also systematic that because you don't know the position where.
It doesn't really matter, yeah. It's a cloud of atoms and your laser is going through them.
It will matter, that's the point. Because the force that you have from the satellite will matter if it's close to the wall versus far away from the wall.
Mm-hmm.
It matters, right? So you have to keep them stable relative to the satellite to a certain precision, which I don't know what that is for this experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's small, by the way.
I'll have to put in the numbers. Yeah.
Because you're still talking about reference frequencies, this is something that will affect the reference frequency.
Let me think about that.
Yeah.
Okay, and this is not really relevant too much to what I've talked about, but this is just some sense of what I think the systematic effects are going to be. Of course, some systematic effects will couple into the statistical sensitivity if they're sort of drifting around on the thousands of seconds scale, which is why I think it's important to look at the systematics as well. But very, very roughly, though, the systematic effects are not the important thing. The important thing is how fast can you average down your frequency sensitivity on the time scale of about 1,000 seconds or so. OK, this is currently speculative. It's not something that I'm building right now, but the idea is that something like this could lead to a frequency standard that's continuous. And so a continuous frequency standard doesn't have the problem of sort of your laser jumping around between measurements, but it also averages much faster with the averaging time. The previous one went as 1 over the square root of tau. This one goes inversely in tau. And so you can win quite a lot by building continuous optical standards. No one's really looking into continuous optical standards right now because for some of these, the systematic effects are big. And so it would be an issue if you wanted to use these to redefine the SI second or as something sitting at NRC in a primary clock lab. However, something like this could be the right thing for gravitational wave detection. So this is one of the directions in which I'm also looking into these things. Okay, that's the summary. There are more details in these papers on the archive. Love to hear your comments. If you have any more questions or want to talk to me more or tell me what I should watch out for, et cetera, please don't hesitate to find me. I'm around all day today, but if you miss me, feel free to email me. I'd love to hear from all of you. Thanks very much. So any questions, I'd be happy to.
So this is kind of a dumb question, but when you say a continuous clock, do you mean the probing laser is a continuous wave? Is that all you mean?
No. See, the probing lasers, even in the regular clocks, are still continuous.
Okay.
But you sort of make stroboscopic measurements on the atoms. Because the point is your atoms are not continuously available. So in these typical sort of trapped atom kind of experiments, what happens is you trap your atoms, you whack them, and then see how long it takes them to ring down. So think again about your sort of tuning fork kind of clock, right? So you whack them, see how long it takes them to ring down, and while they're ringing down, you sort of ask them what they're doing, and you stabilize your laser to that. However, they're not continuously available. They ring down, then you have to sort of reinitialize them, whack them again, see what happens. And so that's what I'm calling a pulsed clock. That's sort of the most common way to do these things. A continuous clock would be where the atoms are continuously available. So let's say you have a stream of atoms flowing past you, and you can sort of, at every moment, ask an atom, some atom, what it's doing. The trouble with that, of course, is because the atoms are moving, there are some systematics that come in because of their motion, so you need to watch out for those. But if you can control those, though, you have a stabilization signal that's continuously available, and you can sort of constantly make your laser track what the atoms are doing. And so that relaxes the requirements on your laser having to maintain its stability between sort of stroboscopic measurements of the atoms. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks.
What do you estimate is the time scale for you to have the prototype or have enough confidence that you would like to have?
I'd love to do it in less than 5 years. I think it's very feasible in terms of at least demonstrating that it's going to work. And if the technique works, shrinking it down into something that's plug and play is engineering at that point. Engineering doesn't necessarily mean easy, but engineering means doable. And so I think the physics of this is pretty straightforward. It's the engineering that's going to be the fun and interesting part, but I do think on sort of a 5-year scale, I'd love to have something that I can throw up in the air and keeps working.
Do you need these dedicated satellites, or can you use existing satellites and have this as a little like parasite that feeds off?
Right. So that would be the nice thing, right? So you don't need a full scale mission just to do this. You can just sort of put them on any satellite that's going beyond the Earth's orbit, for example. That's the grand hope, because right now, like I said, Cassini already gets loaded with the frequency standard because it needs to talk back to Earth. And so if we can make these things at that level, then it doesn't need special satellites. You can just sort of pop them on as parasites, as you say.
Okay.